Welcome to the London Walks podcast. This episode, Theatrical London, presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding.
Hello, so episode 11, this is Theatrical London we're doing now, aren't we, Adam?
Yeah, the Theatrical London podcast, the next episode in the London Walks podcast season, and we're looking at theatre.
We're looking at theatre, and I'm going to be talking about, I'm going to be interviewing a friend of mine called Paul Hilton, who some of you may know from, if you saw Dr. Faustus, Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, which is part of the Globe season, not last year, but the year before. Some of you might remember him from that, and I'm going to be interviewing him. He's got some very, very interesting things to say about the theatre, London's theatre.
Great, and you're also going to be talking about superstition, theatricals being superstitious types,
yeah,
I'm led to believe.
Yeah, theatrical superstitious vernacular.
Great.
I'm going to be talking about that.
Well, break a leg with that.
Absolutely.
Did you see what I did there?
Yes.
And I've got a little bit that we're going to do about, in praise of London theatre. I'm a great believer that the London theatre, in all its forms, West End, Fringe, off West End, is the finest in the world. And I'm going to jolly well tell you why I think so.
You're absolutely right about that. And I think during the course of it, we might be kind of recommending some shows to go to, places to eat.
Alongside all of that, our colleague Sean will be enlivening the proceedings with a theatrical anecdote or two. Here he is now.
This is at the National Theatre. There was a new production of Peter Brook's Oedipus, which is very controversial. And the final scene consisted of the chorus thinking, if my memory serves me correctly, "Yes, we have no bananas," as a huge phallus was erected backstage. And Coral Brown, a very experienced actress, said to her friend as this huge phallus arose backstage and said, "No, darling, nobody we know."
So I'm here outside the Royal National Theatre, and I'm with one of my great friends, Paul Hilton. Now, we went to drama school together, didn't we, Paul?
Yes, I did.
We went to the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama, which is the most...
It wasn't royal when we went.
No, it wasn't. No, no. But it is probably the most prestigious of all the...
Welsh drama schools.
Welsh drama schools. since that, Paul has gone on to work at the Royal National Theatre, the Royal Court, the Royal Shakespeare Company, the Globe, the Donmar, the Royal Exchange, Broadway, West End, nominated for Olivier Awards. I think one of the most irritating questions you can ask an actor is, how do you remember all those lines? So, Paul, how do you remember all those lines?
Repetition, Andy.
Just repetition.
Sheer repetition.
Okay.
Like anything, you know, you just say it enough, it sticks in.
Actors, when you ask them which you prefer, theatre or film and television, they often say the stage, theatre.
Yeah.
Why is that then?
Well, I would think it's probably because you actually feel like you're doing something most of the time in theatre. You're telling a story and you're moving forward and you're on. Whereas in the other TV film work, you know, for the most part, you're not on. You're very much switched off in a trailer or shivering away, waiting in between setups, trying to sustain a kind of an energy.
Yeah.
And obviously you don't have it doesn't go from A to Z like it does in the theatre, so you don't have the sense of a journey. You're jumping around a character's story more often than not with TV film. So the live experience of actually going on a journey from 7:30 till 10:30, 10 o'clock is second to none in terms of an experience.
Right.
Incomparable to TV in that respect.
Our walkers often ask us to recommend a play to go and see. Mm. Is there anything right now that you would recommend straight from the horse's mouth?
Andy, as a parent, you know, we don't get out much to the theatre, but in terms of what... I know Blurred Lines, The Shed has done some wonderful work, which is a pop-up venue outside the National Theatre.
Right.
And they've programmed... I think, in fact, they've programmed another year because it's been such a success. So they're now... It was originally there for 1 year. It's now going to be there for 2 years. There's a show on there called Blurred Lines at the moment.
Right.
Some great actors in it, which looks very interesting. And what else? I'm not really a musical theatre type, but I suppose... Book of Mormon's quite popular, isn't it?
Yeah, very popular, yeah.
A few people have known I've seen that.
And if you want a bite to eat before the theatre, any place you go?
Oh, what?
Or afterwards?
That area, Dials, somewhere around there.
Right.
Maybe Sheiky's is always just around the corner, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. I wouldn't be paying for that. Somebody else would be paying for it. Probably you, Andy.
Yep. Now, can I test you on your superstitious theatrical vernacular? Because I'm going to do a little spot on this a little bit later. Break a leg. Do you know where that comes from?
Break a leg. I do, actually, yeah. Reportedly, the first stage manager ever was called Alec. And when the show was about to start, they would shout, the actors would shout...
Is this true, Paul? Are you just making this up right now?
And that's where it comes from. No, okay. I don't know, no. Andy. I really don't. Can you enlighten me?
Thank you, Paul, for those insights. As to the question, can Andy enlighten you regarding theatrical superstition? He most certainly can. And here he is.
Now, we all know that theatricals can be a very superstitious bunch, and none more so than the humble actor. We all know that wishing an actor good luck before they go on stage is considered very unlucky. In fact, we should do the opposite. No, the correct expression is, of course, break a leg, the origins of which are somewhat obscure. Some people say that break a leg is archaic slang for bowing or curtsying. By bending the knee, it would break the line of the leg. So what we are really doing when we wish an actor to break a leg is wishing that said actor receives such rapturous applause that he is required to bow or break the line of his leg over and over again. Another theory is the Shakespearean, in which it is said Elizabethan audiences, rather than clap, would stamp their chairs in appreciation, presumably until their chair legs broke. Or perhaps the Greek theory, in which audience members would stomp their own legs in appreciation until, well, their own legs broke, or at least became very painful. In the vaudeville theory, the legs refer to the side curtain or narrow stage drapes which frame the proscenium arch and mask the wings. So many acts would be booked, more than could possibly be used, and bearing in mind that you were only paid if you appeared on stage, you might therefore have to break the stage leg to get on.
Okay, New York City, pin back your ears. You're not going to like this, but here we go. Theatre is a London thing. Okay, I've upset the Greeks now as well, haven't I? I fully understand all that stuff about the development of the drama, and Sophocles adding the third character, and tragedy, and comedy, and all that malarkey. But what I mean is that London is the greatest city in the world in which to enjoy theatre. It's the sheer variety. For starters, Shakespeare wrote here. He's not the Bard of Stratford-upon-Avon at all. He was born there, fair enough, but he's the Bard of London because he created, he acted, he wrote his plays here. In matters bardic, we're seldom very far away from the line, facts about the life of William Shakespeare are notoriously few. But here's a fact. In whichever form Shakespeare existed, he was a Londoner. The reconstructed Shakespeare's Globe Theatre stands on Bankside here in London. The Globe has the first thatched roof to be permitted in London since the Great Fire in 1666, when we found out that thatched roofs tend to burn really very, very well. And within that wooden O, Shakespeare comes alive. If you were unlucky enough to have a classroom experience of Shakespeare where you sat praying for the bell to ring, or for death, either would have been fine, to end your misery, then get down to the Globe and be cured. Great atmosphere, great plays, great acting, and, best of all, some critics get all sniffy about its lack of reverence. All the better, if you ask me. The current helmsman at the Globe is one Dominic Drumgool, writer of the larrikin classic Will and Me, in which he details a walk from Stratford to London in emulation of the Bard. Drumgool is a great director born out of London's fringe theatre scene. During his tenure at the Bush Theatre in the 1990s, which back then could be found above a pleasantly dingy pub on Shepherd's Bush Green, he stood up to the great Royal Court Theatre, our crucible of new writing, and matched them punch for punch. My particular favourite Bush play from this period was Snoo Wilson's Darwin's Flood, set in Charles Darwin's fevered mind on his deathbed, in which Mary Magdalene, Nietzsche, and a bike-riding Jesus fought out a war of ideas. Encapsulated in that one play is the scope of reference and ambition typical of the London fringe. Pub theatre still thrives. Okay, the legroom isn't always the best, and air conditioning is often a concept too far, but a vibrant theatrical experience can often be had off the beaten track, away from the West End. In the West End, we deal with the downside first. It is too expensive, and the sharp practice of booking fees remains daylight robbery, adding insult to injury. But there is always the half-price ticket booth in Leicester Square, or TKTS, as it is now known, pronounced, I think, tickts, which led one American London walker to ask the question, did the ticket booth have its vowels blown off in the Blitz? Good question, I thought. They sell seats on the day, two for the price of one. It should be every theatre goer's first London stop. Price aside, the West End remains a centre of excellence. It was where the modern popular musical was reinvented and saved from mothballs in the 1980s. It is where the world's longest running play still goes strong, The Mousetrap, from 1952. And it's where American actors, from Elizabeth Moss to Jack Lemmon, come to flex their theatrical muscles before a very discerning audience indeed. The great 1960s playwright based in Islington, Joe Orton, once observed, "Only money is made in New York. Reputations are made in London." The West End is often enhanced with a production or two from our subsidised National Theatre. We arrived very late at the party when it came to National Theatres, 1963, by which point the Irish had beaten us by nearly 60 years. Since 1976, the National Theatre has been housed in an angular, purpose-built concrete structure on the South Bank. Not His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales' favourite London landmark, suffice to say, but he surely couldn't argue with the sumptuous legroom there. London has more than 100 theatres to choose from. So which one is my favourite? Well, I love them all in their own way. They were all my sons, as Joe Keller says at the end of Arthur Miller's play of the same name. Enter the National Theatre once more, where I saw the much-missed James Hazeldene on unforgettable form in a scorching production of Arthur Miller's play. Aha, you say, a New York writer, proving that London theatre relies on New York for great drama. Of course it does, especially our National Theatre. Without international work, notably from Ireland, our National Theatre would be a parochial establishment indeed. Instead, our National Theatre is an international National Theatre, a window on the world. And you can still see a play at the National Theatre for a mere £12, which is almost as much of a bargain as a London walk.
This is from a repertory company I was privileged to play with. This is the trial scene, Merchant of Venice. The Duke is berating Shylock, and the actor said, "Shylock, the world thinks, and I think so too, that thou but leavest this," he was supposed to say, "this fashion of thy malice to the last hour of act." And instead the actor came out with, "Shylock, the world thinks, and I think so too, that thou but leavest this mashing of thy phallus to the last..."
Yeah, I mean, I love the Globe. They do Midsummer Night's performances there as well, and they do midnight performances, which is wonderful. I kind of remember seeing a show there at kind of midnight and then kind of walking back afterwards and walking over the Millennium Bridge, and just so inspiring. I mean, just always packed out, wonderful kind of vibe there, and loads of energy. It's always great seeing a show there. I love it.
At the Globe, they had a temporary green room backstage in the yard behind the actual theatre. It was a garden shed, basically, with cables run out there and a fridge, and it worked as a green room, a place where the actors could have a drink after the show. It was their pub, and so they called it the Corky Arms, and it was called the Corky Arms because of the scene in King Lear when they grab Gloucester and they shout, "Take him, bind his Corky Arms," in the scene just before they pluck out his eyes. So the Corky Arms was the name of their pub backstage there.
Brilliant. was there was going to be the private theatre, which eventually Shakespeare's The King's Men performed in the Blackfriars Theatre, which is on the other side of the river. And they've made a kind of faithful reproduction of perhaps of a private theatre now, which has just opened, which is part of the original plans, part of Sam Wanamaker's original plans. And they've just opened with The Duchess of Malfi. And they've got two other plays coming on this season, which are going to be The Night of the Burning Pestle and The Malcontent, which are originally performed by the children's theatre companies. So I think one of those, I think The Malcontent is going to be performed by a children's company. They're going to be between the ages of 11 to 18, which is what it originally would have been, which is going to be fascinating. How are they going to deal with that incredible language? Of course, they would have done originally, you know. Some of Ben Jonson's greatest plays were written and performed by children, the children's theatre companies at the Blackfriars. So I'm really looking forward to seeing those particular two plays.
They make a good job of that sort of thing, the idea of let's try this and see if it works, both traditional practice and new practice. I remember in the first season, they were selling food in the yard, beer and hot dogs, yeah, I think it was, in an echo of the practice of Shakespeare's day, but it didn't work because it was annoying. You know, you could hear them haggling for change and stuff during the play. And so they tried it, it didn't work, so they threw it out the window, which I really like about the Globe. They're not at all stuffy. There's always a big idea. Yeah, let's try this.
And I think they stuff in there 1,500 people or so. Although the original theatre, maybe 3,000 people would have been squashed in there. So if you stood there, you'd have been there, the penny stinkers.
Quite. I think this is the thing we can't convey in a podcast, is the smell of the place must have been something astonishing.
No bathrooms.
Quite so. No restrooms, as they say. say what you like, it took an American to come here and make that theatre for us. Yeah. We are an ungrateful bunch. And Sam Wanamaker, thank you.
I think along the whole kind of length of that Bankside would have been, was an industrial wasteland. So it's been, the whole area has been gentrified and, you know, re-energised. It's a wonderful part of London to walk now today, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Particularly all along, you know, a Sunday, and you've got, you know, Borough Market, and you've got the Tate Modern, and just those wonderful views across the Millennium Bridge towards the City of London and St Paul's. Mm-hmm. So it's an inspiring place to be.
Now, why is it that actors are so superstitious about saying the name of that famous play starting with M and written by William Shakespeare, which I can safely refer to as the Scottish Play, or Macca's, or the Scottish Business, the Glam's Comedy, or even just that play? Well, it is said to bring bad luck to cast and crew, and many productions have in fact encountered unfortunate circumstances. The supposed origin of the story is that Shakespeare used authentic witches' chants in the play, and as punishment, real witches cast a curse, condemning it for all time. If legends are to be believed, bad fortune started fairly early on. In the first ever reputed production in 1606, the boy playing the lead's wife became feverish and died backstage. A further tradition says that Shakespeare had to take over the part. One version even holds that Shakespeare played the role badly and later asked his fellow actors never to mention that play again. It certainly has been the bete noir of some of our greatest actors. In a 1937 production, a heavy counterweight crashed to the stage, narrowly missing Laurence Olivier by only inches. In a 1942 staging with John Gielgud, three actors, two witches and Duncan, died, and the set designer committed suicide. And of course, Peter O'Toole, in the title role of The Old Vicar in 1980, was mercilessly hammered by the critics. Of course, the play itself is soaked in blood, violence and disorder, and so provides fertile ground for dark musings. When cast and crew are expecting accidents, any mishaps are uniquely bound to be remembered. Every old actor has his or her own Macca's story that gets reverently passed on to the younger ones, and so the curse persists, feeding upon its own reputation. Nevertheless, notice how during the course of this recording, I myself have been very careful not to tempt fate. But don't worry. If you were to say that cursed title, the remedy, the antidote is well known. You simply leave the room, close the door, spin around three times, say a dirty word, or spit some say, then knock on the door and ask to be let back in. If you can't do all that, you simply quote from Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 4, "Angels and ministers of grace, defend us."
So, before we go, do you have any recommendations for favourite theatres, favourite restaurants?
Well, favourite restaurants, I would say, after a show, Joe Allen's.
Joe Allen.
That's on Exeter Street, just behind where The Lion King is on.
Yes.
Beforehand, something cheap and cheerful, the West End Kitchen. Well, I used to go to the West End Kitchen. It's like school dinners a little bit, but cheap, cheerful, you get a theatrical meal beforehand. Great.
Sure.
And the West End Kitchen is on Panton Street, which is where the comedy theatre. Is that the Pinter Theatre?
It's now the Pinter Theatre, yes, because there was talk when Harold Pinter was alive of renaming the comedy theatre where he had so many successes, renaming it while he was alive as the Pinter Theatre, to which Tom Stoppard said, wouldn't it just be easier if Harold changed his name to Harold Comedy, which I quite liked. But yes, Panton Street is exactly where that is. Yes, cheap and cheerful, but, you know, reliable. And next time, we're leaving the theatre behind. In fact, what we're going to do next time on the podcast, while I think of it, is we're going to do a part of London that's been described as show business for ugly people. It's politics. We're going to look at Westminster and political London.
This one's about Donald Wolfit, who was touring the country doing various sort of Shakespeare stuff. And after one particular performance, tomorrow night, I will play Romeo and my wife will play Juliet. And a voice from the circus said, your wife is Sally Aldoa. Donald Wolfit replied, nevertheless, she will play Juliet.
London Walks podcast was compiled, produced and presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding.
This episode also featured the talents of Karen Pierce-Goulding and Sean Seymour.
For details of the full programme of London Walks, London's best guided walking tours, go to www.walks.com. The London Walks podcast was an APB production.